Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser sehr brisanten Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, am Dienstag, dem 10. September 2024, aufgezeichnet mit einem sehr prominenten Gast. Ich werde dann gleich auf Englisch wechseln, damit er auch versteht, was ich hier zu sagen habe. Ich freue mich sehr. I'm really glad and I'm honored that in our program today I can say hello to Marko Djuric. Marko Djuric is the foreign minister of Serbia. He's one of, you could say, young politicians who have achieved a lot in their life. And he has really a great experience if you look into Serbian politics. He was the ambassador of Serbia to the United States. So we probably can talk a bit about the coming elections. I'm very curious what you see. You have been, Foreign Minister Djuric, you have been the youngest advisor to the President of Serbia in foreign policy. You have been part of the negotiation team, which was about to discuss Serbia's membership of the European Union. You have been the director of the Office for Kosovo and Metohija from 2014 to 2020, which is a issue of crucial importance, also das Thema Kosovo natürlich ein ganz wichtiges Thema. You have been involved in the reconstruction of houses and infrastructure in this region, in this area. So you are really a very experienced, also practically experienced politician. And then when I look on your CV, I see also that you ran the Berlin Marathon in 2019. So you have a lot of time for sports as well. And you are fluent in English and Hebrew, and you have knowledge of French and Russian. You're also married and father of three daughters. Is that correct, Mr. Foreign Minister? Did I summarize it factually accurate?
I'm practically blushing after this wonderful introduction, but I have to say, yes, for the most part, that's my CV, at least.
Great. So thanks again and welcome to our program. My first question, let's touch on the issue of Ukraine, of the war, the painful war in Ukraine, Russia, etc. How is Serbia coping with the situation in Ukraine? What is the major challenge at this particular moment?
The war in Ukraine has had profound and deep consequences in the Balkans, not just in Serbia. And while we in Serbia really have generally in the past decade or so tried to shift the focus of our politics and really try to emphasize growth, development of our infrastructure, economic development, rebuilding our ties with the rest of Europe, this war, the invasion of Ukraine, has increased the level of tensions in our region. And some of the volatilities that remain, that are kind of a negative legacy from the 1990s, visibly reappeared, re-emerged as a result of the ongoing hostilities. Also, I must say that we've seen an influx of refugees, both Ukrainian speaking and Russian speaking. We've seen many, many tens of thousands of people come to Serbia from Ukraine. We've tried to offer them shelter and to welcome them to our country. We've seen also tens of thousands of people from Russia who do not necessarily fall in line with the mainstream of politics there or whatever other reasons they may have to come to Serbia. So we've seen our share of impact, both regionally and when it comes to Serbia. And I must say that our primary focus is currently to keep stability in our region and keep a positive economic growth despite the war, which has strained our economy, but we are still able to boast this semester with a growth rate of 4.7%. Can you just imagine how high it would have been if it weren't for this horrific war?
In the conversation I had with your president, Alexander Vucic, a few months ago, he had a very gloomy picture, very gloomy assessment. He said he was ready to prepare for a big catastrophe in Europe concerning this war. He even thought of, that the scenario of expanding huge war is very realistic. Do you share this assessment? Do you think the situation has become worse, or are they beams of light? How is the war going? Who is winning? What's happening?
I think the statement by President Vucic was in fact very responsible. And I think all world leaders should understand the gravity of the situation and the possible implications of the conflict on the wider international community. This is not just a regional conflict. This is a conflict between great powers. And such a conflict drags the entire humanity one way or the other, either economically or politically or militarily, sometimes even culturally, into a path of conflict. And having traveled, the world in recent years from, the Pacific Island nations that are faced with climate change and challenges related to the climate change, which is now being neglected as a result of this war, to the huge tragedy that's ongoing in Sudan with numerous thousands of people being killed. And all of this is now somehow, not in the focus as a result of this horrific war. And of course, there's a latent threat due to the fact that countries with nuclear armaments are implicated, that this could escalate into something that could have irreversible consequences for humanity.
How big is the danger of a nuclear escalation in the Ukraine war? We see these offensive measures by Ukraine into Russian territory. There is, of course, the ongoing pressure from the Western side, from the West, which wants to put Russia into a difficult situation. We have heard that our politicians said Russia should never be allowed to win this military conflict. Is there the danger of a nuclear war still big? How big do you see it is?
First of all, let me say that Serbia is in this conflict firmly on the side of international public law and the UN Charter, which means that we condemn any acts of aggression against sovereign and internationally recognized states. And we fully support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity over its entire territory. Having said this, this is not a political game. And this conflict should not be a zero-sum game. And we should all try and support all avenues that could lead us to some kind of a ceasefire, some kind of a compromising solution, some kind of a cessation of killing and the atrocities that we are continuously seeing on the ground in the past 2 years. So it is a very difficult situation, and every rational person who analyzes history knows that since the beginning of man, every weapon that man has mastered has been used more often than not since the moment it was invented. And I think we are actually pretty lucky to live in a period in which there has been only one usage of atomic bomb since it was invented officially. That was, of course, in 1945 in Japan, when two cities were annihilated by these bombs. But this doesn't give us the right to hope or to believe that this won't be used in the future as well. And I think we have a huge responsibility to pressure political circles to pressure decision makers to abandon conflict as a means of resolving political disputes. We, having suffered so much in former Yugoslavia, unprecedented suffering, we know we are among the nations who are unfortunate enough to know that conflict does not resolve, armed conflict does not resolve political disputes.
Yeah. How to bring peace to Ukraine? What would you say, what would your proposal be in an EU meeting? How to bring peace to Ukraine?
I'm not courageous or brazen enough on behalf of small Serbia to speak out in that sense. Privately, I could tell you, you know, as a private citizen always, that, you know, abandoning warfare as a method and abandoning zero-sum games is something that is a necessity. Serbia maintains a position that, of course, war as a method represents a crime under international law in itself, and that any form of aggression is unacceptable.
Do you see any changes in the attitude, especially in the European Union? It was striking to me that before the summer holiday, we heard President Zelensky saying, well, we need to negotiate with Russia. Now we have Chancellor Scholz in Germany. Are these harbingers, are these symptoms of a new atmosphere of, well, not cooperation, but at least of a possible dialogue instead of just military confrontation?
I can only tell you that not just Serbia, but many nations across the world, and certainly in our part of the world, would vote with both hands if they could for some kind of a revival of a peace process. But currently, I don't see one on the horizon. And I do hope, again, that the sooner the better we revert to dialogue as a method. I'm afraid I'm not overly optimistic. I cannot share with you some revolutionary new ideas or news, because unfortunately I do believe that all sides involved are still hoping that they will win an outright victory. I do not believe that this will happen, though. It is very unlikely to happen. But now it seems that power players and centers of political power are reluctant to take over the burden of responsibility to breaking the news to, you know, their broader backers or their broader publics, to break the news that, well, maybe we won't be able to, you know, accomplish what we set out to accomplish when we started this, or, you know, what we set out to accomplish when we engaged in this.
You have been ambassador of Serbia to the United States, so you know profoundly the United States. It's always a bit the question, what actually is the goal of the United States in this whole conflict? And do you have an explanation? What is your theory? What's the role of the United States? I've heard that the President Xi in China has said, well, for the war to stop, Washington needs to make a phone call. I don't know what your assessment is. What is the role of the United States in this whole difficult situation?
Well, there definitely needs to be a whole lot of phone calls from a whole lot of interlocutors and parties, because this has become really a global mess in many ways. Speaking on behalf of small Serbia, I can only say that we are always there as a party that wants to foster dialogue, to support, dialogue as a method, as opposed to what we have witnessed in the Balkans. I cannot dare to, speak as an analyst at the moment, because I'm Serbia's foreign minister. Otherwise, I would give you a detailed description of my impression of what U.S. foreign policy priorities are and what the challenges
Well, we can. You can speak as a private citizen on this program. It's no problem. We're in Switzerland. You know, it's absolutely easygoing if you express your opinion.
No, but speaking honestly, I do believe that it's more than just Russia and Ukraine, and that we really need a concert of great powers to get involved and try to bring this fighting to an end. And there needs to be a political will and a dialogue. I'm really sorry that there is a paralysis at the UN Security Council. We're marking these days yet another anniversary of the UN Charter and so forth. I think it would be extremely important if, as part of global efforts to try and put this conflict to an end, we would maybe use the United Nations as yet again one of the platforms for achieving this dialogue.
How big is the pressure on Serbia in this conflict to take sides? I mean, I see your country is always in the spotlight. You get criticized from time to time from all sides. How big is the pressure on you also as a foreign minister? The people call you and say, well, you know, Serbia has to stay on this side or stay on that side, because to my knowledge, to my impression, your country is trying to balance, probably also to build bridges. How difficult is it as a bridge builder to live in today's world?
Well, in a world in which people are pounding actual bridges, it's not easy to try and be a bridge builder. But I can tell you one thing. We firmly believe that Serbia needs to pursue a balanced foreign policy, and that by doing so, it can actually contribute to regional and global stability. And having said this, we are not neutral when it comes to values. We are not neutral when it comes to adherence to international public law or Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. We have repeatedly supported it at the United Nations. We have provided various forms of humanitarian aid on one hand. On the other hand, we have a specific situation because both Ukraine and the Russian Federation support our view on our territorial integrity in our territorial issue, our territorial dispute in the case of the breakaway province of Kosovo and Metohija. Mm-hmm. So both Russia and Ukraine support Serbia's view on this, and we view the peoples of Ukraine and Russia as friendly towards us historically. Mm-hmm. So for us, this is something which is even at an emotional level very difficult to process, to grasp. And unfortunately, we have seen similar examples in former Yugoslavia, very similar nations under wrong leaderships going after each other. We just hope that this will end as soon as possible. And of course, we are faced with a tremendous amount of pressure to fully or exclusively take a position that would be beneficial to only one party in the conflict. But we have decided, and we have actually national consensus in Serbia, more or less, to pursue our own independent course on this issue, which we believe is principled and very much firmly adhering to principles of international law.
Talking as a journalist, I see that, of course, in the media, reflecting the atmosphere also of politics, it's especially in the so-called Western part of Europe or in the Western world, there is the theory that, of course, the Russian president is exclusively to blame for everything what happened, and every step towards him is some kind of appeasement, which, of course, is overshadowed by historical experience. We know the 30s, the 40s, etc. This is the notion in the West. You know, Russia is to blame. Russia is guilty, which of course is also the impediment, you know, for every kind of dialogue. What is the misunderstanding of this conception of this conflict?
Well, I think that the ideological rift between the sides has increasingly appeared in the years after the breakup of the Soviet Union, instead of completely disappearing. Actually, after 1990, after 1991, everyone rational would expect that the former Soviet republics, Russia as the biggest former Soviet republic, would become permanently closer to Europe. We should always ask ourselves, have we done enough to, you know, bridge this gap, historic gap that has been built during the times of communism? And almost a philosophical debate, I wouldn't enter too much into it now. But I can tell you one thing. Serbia as a country is very often subject of criticism on both sides. Sometimes we are facing criticism from Russia because we are voting for UN resolutions condemning their invasion of Ukraine, or siding with Western powers at the OSCE in the question of Ukraine, for providing aid or things like that. Sometimes we are faced with criticism by some Western political circles for maybe having a more nuanced approach than some of the countries in the region to this issue. But I firmly believe that we should stick to our own policy, which is deeply rooted in Serbia's foreign policy DNA since practically the Middle Ages. I know that we're often in the Balkans labeled as people who are too much speaking about history, but in fact, our country, our people here, we have a long-running history of being West in the East and East in the West, if you want. And this does not prejudge, of course, the fact that one of our key priorities is to join the European Union. I'm just referring to the fact that we are very much striving to maintain our own position, our independent decision-making process.
I mean, you're mentioning it. We're living in an age of misunderstandings. I mean, it's really amazing also to my perception. There are so many people around who think they are absolutely 100% sure that something is like that it's not different. And of course, most of the time, it's all misunderstandings. Now, what's the biggest misunderstanding currently about your country, about Serbia? You have here the possibility to speak up against these misunderstandings, especially focused on your country.
There are so many misconceptions. I really don't know where to start. For the beginning, most of the people in some key capitals, in not just ordinary citizens who can always be forgiven for not, you know, looking into political issues more in a more detailed way, but members of the political class have not taken a fresh look at the Balkans since the 1990s. And for many people I run into, they have last analyzed events in the Balkans in the 1990s. Things have, since that period of time, moved on and shifted so significantly beyond recognition. Even the skyline of the city from where I'm speaking, Belgrade, has completely changed. The paradigm of politics in Serbia has shifted from identity, ideology, territorial issues, which has dominated our political life throughout most part of the 20th century, for all the right and wrong reasons, has shifted towards development, economic growth of, and development of our infrastructure. Belgrade has been awarded to host the Expo 2027 exhibition, which is a huge thing. And now we have this wonderful new thing on which we can focus our national efforts, as part of which we are building 500 kilometers of new highways, two new high-speed railways, one already completed, as part of which we are attracting even more foreign direct investments into Serbia. And for example, who would have thought when you say Serbia that it is a country which was the first in Europe to introduce computer coding as a compulsory subject to its elementary schools, 5th, 6th grade, and even for the first graders now we have a subject which is called digital world. So, I mean, this does not fit into the stereotype of a backwards, conservative Balkan nation. And indeed, it is not. It is a country striving to be accepted as an equal member of the international community, particularly of the European community. And we are a small nation in terms of population and territory, maybe, but we definitely have a mentality of a much bigger nation, which sometimes works in our favor, sometimes not that much.
But it's, I think it's also a huge quality that you are a small nation, because the big nations at the moment, they tell us that we are entering a new dark age. On the one side are the democracies, and on the other side are the autocracies, for example, China and Russia, and we shouldn't touch them. And that's my impression. I would be curious to know how you see it. I see a new Iron Curtain being drawn up, a new kind of absurd version of the Cold War, which seems to somehow materialize. And we Swiss, small states, we have always been open to the world. We have to be friends with everybody. Do you share my observation? Are the big ones, the big guys, the big countries, are they trying to talk us into a new kind of Cold War? Or is that just a hallucination? How do you see the world from the Serbian small state perspective?
Well, as the old proverb says, there is nothing new under the sun. So it's not really new that, big powers or concerts of powers try to pressure smaller nations into political submission, or try to impose their worldviews, or try to steer their foreign policy. What is new, in a way, is that all of this combined with new technologies means much deeper involvement into domestic audiences, domestic political debates, from various ideological directions. And sometimes in Serbia, I feel like in that movie Casablanca, because there are various salesmen coming from various parts of the world and various important political centers trying to lure us into their camp, or to force us into their camp, or to sell us their ideas, their ideologies. We really feel that we have one interest to serve, and that is the interest of the people who have put us in place to represent them. So we are in a way blind towards any kind of other type of pressure. And we are firmly focused to work in the direction which will bring more breadth to the table of people in Svilajnac, in Despotovac, in Leskovac, in Niš, and that will also create an environment for them to be able to freely express themselves. Mm-hmm. You see, in Serbia, we have refused to introduce any kind of censorship of any international media outlets. Everyone is free to say what they want. This also is sometimes risky for the government because, for example, when we make a strategic political announcement or decision which is not conducive for the will of some political centers, then they use either their local affiliates or their global affiliates to try and pressure our public public opinion. But I think we have built a kind of a resilience to this because we have gone through the horrible crisis of the breakup of Yugoslavia in 1990s, and we do have a kind of resilience. And I think we have a very, this is important for me to say, if I may, we have a very honest and straightforward approach. What I'm telling you, I equally say in Washington, in Brussels, in Beijing, in any other capital of the world. And we really want to be a reliable partner to everyone.
Are China, countries like China, Russia, others, are these countries enemies of the West?
Well, it's not up to me to, you know, make a determination of this type, but I can say that they're not enemies of Serbia. And I can tell you that we are striving to resolve global issues through dialogue, not through conflict. And we do not believe in mechanisms such as sanctions. We've had a very bitter experience of our own in the 1990s when we had a very horrible regime. I was actually fighting as a young activist against that regime. This regime was horrible towards all ethnic communities in former Yugoslavia, including the Serbian community, but others as well. And sanctions didn't work, actually. They made the regime stronger. They made the cronies of the regime get rich. They increased social cohesion around the leaders of the regime. And they actually delayed the fall from power of that regime, which on the ground led to immeasurable consequences and loss of life. And probably the conflicts in former Yugoslavia could have ended earlier had these mechanisms been used otherwise. So, and we also have a principal position that we do not believe in sanctions as such. However, having said this, I want to underline that this doesn't mean that we condone the aggression over Ukraine, for example, the violation of its territorial integrity and sovereignty, that we definitely strongly disapprove of such actions, but we are in favor of finding rational ways out of such situation.
Does Serbia still want to become member of the European Union, observing that Brussels and the EU is treating some of its member states, let's put it mildly, not probably always with the proper respect? You know, if you look at countries like Poland or Hungary, one has the impression whenever a head of state says something that they don't like in Brussels, he somehow gets disciplined, you know. Is Serbia still keen on entering the European Union in the shape as it currently is?
Well, we in Serbia love to be part of greater projects. It gives us a collective feeling of greater significance and importance, if I may say, if I can generalize and speak a bit about the collective psyche. And if you look at our history, we've tried to be the Piemonte of the unification of Southern Slavs twice. We tried to be the pillar of the creation of a Yugoslavia that would gather all Southern Slavs. We failed, unfortunately, miserably two times. But not without being ready to sacrifice entirely for achieving this noble goal. Similarly, but hopefully much more successfully, now we believe that Serbia has a lot to offer to the broader European project. We are not coming to the European table to ask for money. We actually are coming with a very healthy economy, although we are not as rich as some of the Western countries, but our foreign debt to GDP ratio is 50%, and it has actually decreased from 79% of GDP to 50% of GDP in less than a decade. We have more than doubled the size of our GDP in less than one decade. We have attracted 65% of all foreign investments in Southeastern Europe in recent years. And we really have a positive momentum. So on one hand, I think we can contribute with 7 million more pairs of hands to a stronger Europe. On the other hand, we believe we can protect some of our own national interests better if we have a say at the European table, because anyhow, European foreign security, agricultural, whatever kind of policy you think of is being determined and influencing us, mm-hmm. but without having our say. So mm-hmm. what we do not want to end up being is we do not want to end up being the Puerto Rico of Europe. And I've been to Puerto Rico. It's a beautiful land. It's a territory which is part of the United States. The United States have significantly contributed to their development. But unfortunately, they do not have an equal vote in U.S. Congress as other member states do. So we do not envision such a membership for Serbia. We envision a full-fledged membership, which will also allow us to have our say on key issues. Also, we fully understand that this means that we have to fully adhere to common foreign and security policy of the European Union, and we are ready to sign up to this and to fully implement the common foreign and security policy once we are accepted in European ranks. Until then, we reserve the full right to pursue such a policy which we find in the best interest of our own people.
But are you not afraid that there could be a contradiction between the Serbian concept, for example, of foreign policy, being open to the world, not making enemies, even with countries that are considered enemies in the so-called West, and, you know, the conflict between your, could say, globalized, universalist approach to foreign policy towards a, in my eyes, seemingly narrow-minded approach in the European Union, which, from Swiss perspective, has somehow militarized itself in the last years. It seems that the European Union is becoming much more confrontational. I'm overdoing it, of course, a bit. It's slightly provocative how I say it, but don't you see this potential contradiction? And isn't Serbia's influence big exactly because you're actually not a member of the group, but you're independent and you follow your own way, which, as you know, is also inspiring for a lot of countries who try to imitate your independent ways?
Well, I must say that I agree with you for the most part, but every decision of a strategic nature has its ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And I don't see an immediate, in the next 2 or 3 years, opportunity for us to join the European Union, not because we don't want to, but because there's a lack of political readiness. Yeah. And I think it's a pity, because Serbia could really add value to Europe as a project, also through its extensive network of global contacts. I mean, we were the founders of the Non-Aligned Movement. The first conference of the Non-Aligned Movement was held here, from where I'm actually speaking today. And We still maintain an extensive diplomatic network that spans across all continents, and we maintain special relations, and we have free trade agreements and strategic partnerships with countries well beyond Europe. So we will continue looking beyond just our narrow environment, our narrow circle. Having said this, more than 70% of our trade is with the European Union, and our exports, that more than 70% of our exports go to the European Union. If hopefully soon Europe decides that it wants Serbia to join its ranks, it will be a win-win, I'm convinced. You know, one country to our east, which hasn't been a member of the European Union for 15 years now, both European Union and NATO, and has received more than 90 billion of euros from common European funds, has yet to reach the level of pensions that the state pays here in Serbia with all of these subsidies. And we have received 20 times less from European Union than they did. Of course, we are grateful for any kind of budgetary support, but that's not what we are asking for.
So you're saying you're not coming on your knees begging for money, going to Brussels, but you come as a the same level to contribute politically. One big issue, of course, as far as EU membership is concerned, is the Kosovo topic. You know it very well. Kosovo is for non-Serbians, for non-Kosovarians, a difficult issue. We don't know so much about it. But as far as I have understand it, it's out of the question that Serbia could become member of the European Union without recognizing the independent state of Kosovo. Is Serbia ready to say, okay, we accept the independent state of Kosovo as a precondition to entering the European Union?
First of all, Serbia is fully committed to maintaining peace and stability in Kosovo itself, because we have seen in the past 2.5 years a series of unilateral and uncoordinated actions by Kurti's government, Kurti's regime, aimed at unilaterally changing the situation on the ground. What he has been doing since, unfortunately, the beginning of the war in Ukraine, this more or less coinciding, he has been trying to assume control over Serb-majority areas in the north of Kosovo, particularly, using forceful means. And we have now seen in recent years basically a mirror image, unfortunately, of what used to happen during the 1990s, in a way, in Kosovo. Serb majority areas are now being run by ethnic Albanian mayors. And I'm speaking about municipalities with 98-97% Serbs living there, and Kurti's government has imposed forcefully illegitimate mayors to run these areas, Kosovo-Albanian mayors. They have replaced the police force in the north of Kosovo, which was part of the Kosovo police force, but consisting of Kosovo Serbs, with mono-ethnic Kosovo-Albanian ethnic units, which are engaging in extrajudicial arrests, excessive use of force on a daily basis. Just last night, they brutally beat up 4 youngsters. Every day, there are such examples. We've recorded more than 131 incidents since the beginning of this year alone. And the situation there is really unbearable. Kurti's government has banned any kind of imports of Serbian goods into Kosovo. So not even a single bag of potato chips or even Coca-Cola made in Belgrade cannot be sold or imported into Kosovo. And they have blocked payments, which means that we cannot pay pensions, salaries, welfare, childcare for our citizens in Kosovo and Metohija. This is creating unbearable living conditions. And of course, this is a huge sense of frustration for us. Mm-hmm. I have to say to our viewers, to you, that since May, we have seen 6 consecutive statements by the European Union condemning the actions of Kurti's government, outright condemnation of his government. But this has fallen short of preventing him in engaging in such unilateral behavior. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize for our viewers that we do not see Albanians as our adversaries. We do not see Albanians in the Balkans as our enemies. In fact, we share many things. First of all, we share the region in which we live in. We culturally share many traditions as well. And most importantly, I do believe that we share a future with Albanians. We can only create a prosperous and stable region if we work together, regardless how unpopular this might sound temporarily or tactically, both on the Serbian or the Albanian side. There is one good, very good example of recent cooperation between Serbs and Albanians in the Balkans. This is the bilateral cooperation between Serbia and Albania, where Presidents Vučić and Prime Minister Rama have been able to establish such a relationship, which has enabled us to create a single labor market between Serbia, Albania, and North Macedonia. And in past years, we have seen, in the past year, we have seen more than 200,000 Serbian tourists, for example, visit the Albanian coast. And we have seen thousands of Albanian workers come to work in central Serbia to build these new parts of Belgrade and things like that. So these are positive developments, but Kurti's eco-nationalist regime keeps undermining all of this. They keep trying to push Serbs out of Kosovo. And what they're pursuing is actually a mirror image of policies that were implemented against the Albanians when the West intervened in Kosovo. Mm-hmm. I would love to see whether the West is going to similarly intervene, at least, if not, by using the same type of energy and power, but at least sufficiently so as to prevent the persecution Serbs are now facing in Kosovo. Mm-hmm.
There is one defining event looming all over the world, which is the election in the United States of America. I started this at the beginning. I mentioned that you have been ambassador to the United States. Are you privately hoping that Donald Trump will win, or does your heart beat for Kamala Harris?
Well, if I would share it here, it wouldn't be a secret, but I can tell you one thing. For us, it has been a real struggle to get attention from top management in D.C. The United States are now faced with such multiple challenges on global stage that dealing with some legacy crisis in the Balkans, which has been neglected since the late 1990s, is definitely not among key priorities of top decision makers in the White House or at the State Department and elsewhere. And I would be rooting, frankly speaking, for anyone at all who is ready to pay more attention to the situation in the Balkans. Because to be very honest to ourselves and to others, we won't be able to resolve all open issues in the Balkans without full top-level engagements from those actors, those players, those powers who have been there when the problems were created. So now, when we need to draw our sleeves and work on resolving those problems, we won't be able to resolve them if we are not among the first 20 priorities for the administration. And as ambassador, I'm proud to say that I worked very hard to revamp the relationship between Serbia and the United States. As a foreign minister, I plan to continue doing even more so. In fact, I will travel very soon to Washington, D.C., where we plan to sign an agreement on strategic cooperation in energy sphere between Serbia and the United States. We are looking forward to additional top-level engagements between our two countries, and Serbia would love to see the opening of a strategic dialogue with the United States, which would be beneficial for both countries.
Before I come to my last question, just a very short follow-up question. And do you think that the bombing of Serbia in 1999 has become some kind of a precedent for the breaking of international law? Because it's an event that is also not so much on the perception in many countries, but one probably could argue that at that moment in 1999, somehow this was the battle cry for other breakings of international law. Was it the precedent?
When I look outside my window from the room in which I'm tuning into this interview, I still see the scars from the bombing that happened 25 years ago, a quarter of a century ago. And when I look at the heartbreaking images that we see in Ukraine now, with energy facilities being hit and power being cut to civilian population, I remember the blackouts we had in Belgrade, a city of 2 million people in 1999. And of course, I remember more than 3,000 civilian victims who were killed during what was undoubtedly, according international law, an aggression, in the sense that it was conducted without consent from the Security Council of the United Nations, that it was conducted also in violation of the UN Charter, which prohibits explicitly such activities. Regardless of what the excuse for this aggression was, it was a very dangerous precedent, which is now unfortunately being used by strongmen, by powers that want to establish dominance over other countries. And we also see how the unilateral declaration of independence of Kosovo, which was done outside of the scope of international law, is being used as a precedent. Just to remind our viewers, Kosovo unilaterally declared independence not during the war, not immediately after the war, not even when Serbia was under Milošević regime, which was considered, or rightly considered, as an undemocratic regime. Kosovo declared independence a full decade after Serbs renounced an authoritarian regime, and when in power in Serbia were political parties that were unconditionally in favor of Serbia joining not just the European Union, but NATO. Mm-hmm. And at the time when Serbia was already a member of both the Council of Europe and the OSCE and had a contractual relationship with the European Union. So then Kosovo declared independence. And it declared independence without holding a referendum on it in Serbia. There wasn't even a referendum in Kosovo. There wasn't even a consensus in the parliament in Pristina. It was just a group of majority MPs in the parliament of Kosovo, which was at the time a provincial parliament, which voted to secede from Serbia against Serbia's constitution and against UN Resolution 1244, which stipulated that the maximum degree of autonomy within Serbia should be pursued. So, of course, this set a very dangerous precedent. And you cannot explain to the people of Serbia anytime, or to us who are representing Serbia, why Serbia's territorial integrity and sovereignty is less valuable than the territorial integrity and sovereignty of other countries. Why? How come? It was not during the Milošević regime, during an authoritarian regime. It happened, the secession happened 10 years after that. I'm not falling into the trap of comparing Serbia of the 1990s with the Axis powers, during the Second World War. But even in this case, no one came to the defeated Axis powers 10 years after the war in 1955 to ask more of their territory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They came to them to offer them an embrace, to offer them an equal seat at the table, to offer them respect. That's all that we want, nothing more than that. And of course, we want democracy, we want rule of law, we want human rights for our people in Kosovo, nothing more than that. And we want to offer the same to everyone else, which is extremely important.
Interesting. You mentioned that there are prejudices or even, you know, misconceptions about Serbia, but probably also about the whole of the Balkan area. The Balkan states have always, you know, stirred up feelings, whatever, prejudices. What's the most underrated quality of Serbia, and you could say even of the Balkan world? What is the most underrated quality? What is the contribution to the world at the moment, the most fascinating contribution of your region to the world?
Well, I don't want to speak too much about Novak Djokovic, obviously, and about Nikola Jokic in basketball. Sometimes I like to joke that all people in Serbia are talented in sports. Those who are not are being sent abroad as diplomats. But that's just a joke. I genuinely believe that we are a country that has centuries-long experience and centuries-long experience in surviving in adverse circumstances. We've survived literally every major empire that has appeared in this region. And when I look at the map of the world today and see how many challenges we in Europe are faced with, how many competitors, how many power players who are outperforming us in technology, in economy, in various other walks of life, I do believe that we could benefit from 7 more million pair of capable hands from the people of Serbia. We have many, many talented people in all walks of life. It isn't without a reason that companies such as Microsoft, Google, Oracle are locating their regional research and development centers in Serbia. In fact, Microsoft's biggest R&D center in Europe and best in their own words is now located in Serbia. This tells you that there is a pool of talent here for various things. And I do believe that given the fact that we also have a stable economy, that we have a global outlook, that we have experience with dealing with countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America. In fact, we helped some of those countries come into being because we funded and equipped their anti-colonial struggle during the 60s and 70s and so forth. We can help Europe to be better connected, to be more balanced in some ways, and to be, if you like, more European.
A bridge to the world. Very final point. We have a lot of viewers, of course, in the German-speaking world, in Switzerland, in Germany, in Austria. This has a wide audience in this one. Any final message to our German-speaking viewers? As a Swiss, of course, I want to know, what do you think about Swiss neutrality? But I leave it open to you. Your final message to the German-speaking part of the world of Europe.
Einmal in Serbien, immer in Serbien. I invite you, dear friends, to visit Belgrade, a beautiful city of 2 million people sitting on two great European rivers, the Danube and Sava, the crossroads of civilizations, where the Mediterranean and Oriental temperament meets European culture, history, and tradition, to try out the amazing food, but also to learn more about our culture, our worldview, which is very unique. And you will find that just as we are passionate sometimes about fighting for our own causes, our own issues, we are extremely or loyal once we become friends and partners and allies. And let's seek an extended hand to create something new, something good, something that we were not able to achieve in the 20th century, and to make this partnership with Serbia, with the Balkans, another veritable European success for the 21st century. We could definitely use it. We could definitely use more cohesion, and we could definitely use a more preservation of who we are. And we in Serbia can help with that.
And Swiss neutrality?
Swiss neutrality, I hope you continue it.
Foreign Minister Djuric, many thanks for this conversation. Very interesting, very enlightening. And we're going to see what the United States, what they will bring, what will happen, and probably we can follow up the conversation after the events in Washington. All the best to you. Good luck in this dangerous world, in this dangerous and rough waters of today's time. Privilege and great honor that we could speak to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.